You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We are looking at why violence against women of color is not treated with more urgency or awareness, considering the crises that face black women and girls. 2 in every 5 black women in our country are projected to experience intimate partner violence in their lifetimes. Black women are murdered as a result of this violence at a higher rate than any other group of women. And financial abuse is one of the top reasons why women are often unable to leave. Perhaps you have a painful experience with sexual assault or domestic violence. How has gender-based violence affected you? What resources do you wish were available? We're at 800-642-1234. Tanya Lovelace is CEO of the Women of Color Network, Inc. The organization is based in Pennsylvania, and it's raising national awareness of violence that occurs in communities of color. Tanya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us a framework for what gender-based violence is. How would you define it?
I would say that gender-based violence is an experience in which an individual or individuals are enacting intimate violence, as well as violence that can be happening from a stranger or from a family member, from anyone in their experience that is engaging in emotional violence, physical violence, economic violence, spiritual violence. There are a number of ways in which a person is really engaging in power and control over another person.
So it literally can be happening anywhere.
It can be happening anywhere. There could be almost any tool used to engage in this violence. It can happen to any child, any adolescent, any adult, any person of any ethnicity, any gender, any sexual orientation, from any experience possible.
Well, tell us about your organization, the Women of Color Network. How are you working to eliminate violence against women?
Well, Women of Color Network is a national technical assistance and training organization that works to end violence by centralizing the voices, the wellness, and the leadership of women of color across Asian, African, Latin, Native, Bi, and multiracial descent, and across gender identity and expression. And the way in which we do this work is to ensure that we are in spaces where we can affect systems change, where we can affect change in ways in which people think overall about domestic violence and sexual violence. We work to make sure that people are seeing the linkages between these forms of violence and other forms of violence, such as human trafficking and police brutality and community-based violence. And so we really seek to see this, do this work in a broad way, and to make sure that people see it against the backdrop of such broader global issues as colonialism and imperialism, capitalism, racism, homophobia, and heterosexism. And I know I'm making these in really broad terms, but what I am saying is that women of color have a particular point of view and a particular experience in the way in which domestic violence and sexual violence is happening. And those things are connected to a web of other issues that really surround our communities on a global basis. And so it's important for us to be able to go into systems so that they don't have a one-dimensional approach to doing or to addressing domestic violence and sexual violence, that they are actually really seeing it as linked to other forms of oppression and other issues that individuals have. And we empower or we create spaces for empowered women of color to be able to move forward in utilizing their voices to address these issues, to speak as survivors of forms of violence, and to speak as advocates on behalf of communities that are experiencing this violence.
We're talking with Tanya Lovelace. She's CEO of the Women of Color Network that we're learning about. And for nearly 25 years, Tanya has been working in this area of advocacy and education efforts in the anti-violence against women movement. Are there any sexual assault or domestic violence prevention efforts going on in your area? Can you tell us about them? How have you seen the resources in your area help? Where do they fall short? Join in the conversation at 800 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tanya, you have some really big issues on your plate, and you're addressing them through a lot of interweaving areas. When you look at things like human trafficking and police brutality, how do these issues relate to gender-based violence?
So what I have been and what our organization has been attempting to do is to really lay a table nationally for people to see those connections. And so in 2014, we were witnessing, as the country was witnessing, really, the experiences of Eric Garner and others that had been experiencing homicide and death by at the hands of the criminal justice system. We were also seeing cases such as in the case of Marissa Alexander, who fired a gun shot in her ceiling as a warning shot or as a warning sign to her partner who was attempting to who was being violent to her while she was holding her child, seeing the kind of issues and the ways in which the system was treating her as well. We were at the same time, we had Bill Cosby case. Many things were happening in 2014, and that all converged in us being able as an organization to connect these high profile cases and to see that these were all connected. We were connecting the dots across these senseless acts of violence, police-based militarism, the loss of life, and sort of the indignities that our communities were experiencing. And what we understood is that in the work that we do in domestic violence and sexual assault organizations, that while many of us as advocates were walking around in pain, experiencing this and seeing this, we were not going to be able to talk about this in our programs, because many of our programs still do not see the connection to what we call jagged justice, these injustices that are happening in which our communities don't get pure justice. And when we see someone like Eric Garner be strangled on the street for selling individual cigarettes, we are looking at him and saying, he looks like our father, he looks like our brother, he even looks like our partner. The fact that I would call the police if I'm experiencing violence by my partner, the idea that he may experience a worse fate, and that a worse fate for me may be that he might experience the same type of violence by those who are expected to serve and protect our communities, would be problematic. And so we knew and could see that the connection, and we saw and we heard women saying that it was a problem in their advocacy, that they were seeing women really connect the dots between what was happening publicly with folks being killed in their cars and so forth, and also seeing folks such as Sandra Bland, who was stopped by police and eventually within police custody was killed. What we understood is that it was even dangerous for us to call the police so to be able to receive support.
You saw a lot of women holding back even when they needed help.
Even when they need help.
We're talking about women survivors of violence. Tanya Lovelace, our guide, she's CEO of the Women of Color Network, Inc. Police and prosecutors straight across the country are reevaluating how victims of sex trafficking should be treated. Are you following the Crystal Kaiser case in Kenosha? The 19-year-old is facing life in prison for killing her alleged sex trafficker. What kind of outcome do you want there? What questions do you have about the movement against violence against women? Join in any point this hour, 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Tanya Lovelace right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the epidemic of gender-based violence here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The structural biases against African-American women and girls have devastating consequences, and the statistics bear that out. There was a report by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, found homicides stemming from intimate partner violence disproportionately affect young racial and ethnic minority women. And later this morning, Attorney General Josh Call is set to release the 2019 Law Enforcement Assessment Report on sex trafficking here in Wisconsin. So how do you want the criminal justice system to respond to gender-based violence and sex trafficking crimes? Are there any sexual assault or domestic violence prevention efforts that are really going strong in your area? Tell us about them at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're spending the hour with Tanya Lovelace. She heads up the nonprofit Women of Color Network. Tanya, last year there were stories about young women who had survived sex trafficking. There was Centoya Brown Long. There was the Crystal Kaiser case here in Kenosha. What do these cases tell us about the national conversation surrounding sex trafficking?
Well, what they're telling us is that girls who move through the school to prison pipeline are often victims of sexual assault and child abuse within their own homes, and are often child witnesses and are unsafe in their homes. They find themselves outside of economic and employment opportunities. They find themselves having to often run away or leave their homes, or to survive out in their environment, out in community. And they are often having to leave spaces that are unsafe for them to be in. And so they are then trafficked. So they find themselves in the hands of individuals who seek to do harm. And this has led to cases such as Centoya Brown Long, as well as the Crystal Kaiser. And what we are doing is, it is important for us as Women of Color Network, Inc., to lay a table for those conversations through our Jagged Justice Project. And we held a series of calls last year. And in fact, the day that we held our Jagged Justice call and had rallied folks around the country, organizations to partner and individuals to partner, we were able to send letters and to donate. And on the day we held our call, Centoya received news that she was that she had received clemency. Mm-hmm. But then just a month later, we were holding a call about Crystal Kaiser to connect the dots between her story and Crystal's story. And what we are saying around the country is that these girls are not treated within their humanity, frankly, been a difference in ethnicity. Had this fallen under what folks used to and may still use the term of white slavery, in which it had been white girls who had experienced trafficking, we can't help but believe that there would be a difference in the way that these girls are treated, that they have received, that they were receiving life sentences as girls who had engaged in self-defense against men who were engaging in unlawful behaviors with them. And so they were themselves being violated and found themselves seeking to save themselves. And that is not justice when a system will treat these young ladies differently than the very people who were violating them as adults.
And Kaiser, she admitted to killing her abuser, and now she faces multiple felony charges, including first-degree intentional homicide, possession of a firearm, arson. What does this case mean in the context of the whole movement and when you say connecting the dots?
Well, connecting the dots here, the greatest concern for me and this most recent ruling is that she can't use as a defense in her case that she was a survivor of trafficking by this individual. And so, well, at least she can't talk about the sexual and physical abuse that she experienced. And so really what they've done is erased the history here of the violence that she experienced. And we are trying to connect the dots between the ways in which a criminal justice system that is not built to support individuals such as herself, but to target individuals such as herself, and again, to treat her as a Black girl less than her humanity, is really a problem for us. And we believe that the criminal, that she is now a victim of the system, as well as this individual. And we seek and we want to see her have full clemency as an individual who was engaging in self-defense.
We're talking with Tanya Lovelace. She's CEO of the Women of Color Network. It's an advocacy organization working to stop gender-based and sexual violence. Are you following the Crystal Kizer case in Kenosha, the teenager who is facing a lifetime sentence for killing her alleged sex trafficker? How do you think the criminal justice system should respond? Are you working on restorative justice efforts in your community? How are they going? Join in at 800-642-1234. For email ideas at WPR.org. Tanya, can you tell us about the Blue Lips campaign and what the goal is there?
So it's very interesting how Blue Lips came about. We were in a hotel lobby as a board and staff celebrating being together, but also being a little adventurous and trying on blue lipstick, which was a sort of an outlying thing to be doing in 2016. Times continue to change because people are regularly using different color lipstick. But at the time, for us, it was just this novel thing, and it was just a form of self-care for us. But individuals who were watching us do that came over and said, "What is this with this blue lipstick? Why are you guys putting this on? And what do you guys do and why are you here?" And at that point, we were able to use this blue lipstick as an opportunity to talk about the fact that we do domestic and sexual violence work, and realize that we had now the ability to use this as a campaign. What we began to say is that when a person walks into a domestic violence organization or a sexual assault program with blue lips, it often means that they've experienced some form of injury, some form of pain or hurt. And typically, the color blue is also associated with feeling down and with sadness and depression, which is also something that plagues survivors and plagues various communities of color as well, and is not something that's often talked about. And so we decided to say we were going to flip the script on blue lips, and we were reclaiming the blues. We were asking people to put on blue lipstick as a way to stand in solidarity with women who experience grave statistics, and to really acknowledge that Black women are dying at 2.5 times the rate of white women, that Native women are experiencing sexual assault at 3.5 times the rate of all women, and that we really wanted to use this as a national awareness way to say, step outside of your comfort zone, try on a little blue lips with us, take your blue lip selfies, post it on your page, and stand in solidarity and donate to really support this issue and to help us continue to raise awareness.
And you've seen it really spread around.
We have. Yeah. It's been fun. We've had all sorts of officials put on the blue lips and take blue lip selfies with us. Community individuals, people have used it as an education tool. We've had women in the Dominican Republic and other parts of the in other countries around the world use this. And it's been a way for folks who don't really feel safe to come to a space that is proclaimed to be a domestic violence and sexual assault conversation. They could show up to try on blue lipstick and to have a conversation about self-care and beauty, but then to extend that to then talk about domestic violence and sexual assault. We've been able to see people use that as a tool of extension to really continue to raise awareness.
Tanya, up to this point, we've been really focused on Black women and girls, but how is this violence affecting transgender women?
Transgender women are at the intersections of race, of particularly transgender women of color are at the intersections of race, of gender, of sexual orientation, of gender identity, and they're experiencing transphobia and all sorts of forms of violence and biases, and also are not able often to access economic support or day-to-day employment in many cases. And so they find themselves, again, it's not unlike the school-to-prison pipeline, where many of our trans sisters are finding themselves having to engage in other ways to support and to survive but also find themselves targeted within those spaces. And what we know is that trans women of color are dying at much greater rates than cis women of color, and cis meaning cisgender, where a person's gender identity is in agreement with how they were identified when they were born. What we find is that that folks who seek to do harm do it at the intersections of these various identities. And the more of those identities you layer on, the greater risk that individuals face in violence. And trans women of color are at the greatest rate of that at this point. And we are also using our platform to lift up trans women of color, and particularly trans Black women, who are absolutely dying. There was a point in which we were seeing almost weekly trans Black women dying, and not enough awareness being raised about it.
Tanya Lovelace, our guide, she's CEO of the Women of Color Network, Inc. Have you seen situations where women of color have been targets? Join in 800-642-1234. News is next here on the Ideas Network. Gender-based violence is violence directed against a person because of their gender. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So it's true that Black History Month serves as a great opportunity to celebrate the contributions of African Americans in history, but it's also a time to acknowledge the uncomfortable truth that Black women face domestic violence and homicide at higher rates than other groups. Where do you find hope in the programs operating in your communities to stop the violence? What are you doing to make a difference in this area? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tanya Lovelace is CEO of the Women of Color Network, Inc., that is working to end gender-based and sexual violence, and she stays with us. Tanya, in 2017, you were an advisor to the NFL for its investigation into domestic violence allegations at the time against Dallas Cowboy player Ezekiel Elliott. What was that engagement like for you, that process?
It was a very important and pivotal process in the work of Women of Color Network, Inc., and being able to be at that table and to help to steer that conversation and that investigation alongside others who have been chosen to be a part of that right after the Ray Rice case. It was pivotal in that it would have been probably the first case that they were able to bring to full energy the new approaches that they were taking in addressing domestic and sexual violence. I believe that they had four advisors already in place that were laying the table, but they had and those individuals worked with the NFL to bring us all together in October 2014 to begin to assist them in thinking on a broader scale how they were going to reshape their approach to domestic violence and sexual assault. So by the time the Ezekiel Elliott case had come, we were already prepared. The NFL had already begun to set up new approaches in addressing it.
How big of an issue in the NFL is domestic violence?
I am at this point, I'm not aware of specific statistics that show, you know, so many players have engaged in so much violence. Mm-hmm. But in any profession in which aggression is going to be a part of it, whether we're talking about the military, whether we're talking about, frankly, law enforcement, and whether we are talking about the NFL or any other form of sport that is contact, that you are going to find that there are folks who have a difficult time shutting down those behaviors and not engaging in some form of power and control within their home and within their intimate relationships. And so we believe that is a huge problem within the NFL, but then they would not be alone in that should be seen as something that is connected to various forms of professions that engage in that type of that center, that type of engagement.
Refresh our memories here on the Ezekiel Elliott case. What was happening there?
What was happening is that Elliott was engaged in a relationship with an individual and had engaged in what we believe had engaged in violence with this person over a period of time, over a couple of year period of time. She had sought out support from law enforcement, which case the case had off, these cases have been dropped. And there were, she brought to bear these cases to the NFL. The NFL had also become aware of a most recent case that they were dealing with. And so they made the decision to investigate it themselves. That was one of the resolves that the NFL had made after the Ray Rice case, was that it was important for them to hold their own platform in doing their own research and their own investigation. And as a part of the investigation and then subsequent meetings that were held, and which I was a part of, in the end, the decision was that we did find that there was, from what we believe, evidence that this had occurred and that there needed to be some action that the NFL should take to hold him accountable for his behaviors.
But it took more than a year from the time Ezekiel Elliott was accused of domestic violence for the NFL to hand him a six-game suspension. That's quite a long time.
Well, absolutely. And they are not law enforcement, right? So they are not, they did a very thorough job of investigation. They have folks within the NFL that have domestic violence backgrounds and are also engaged in investigation, have investigation as a part of their profession. And so they knew, but they wanted to take real time in understanding all of the pieces of these cases, and they gave themselves the ability to look beyond what often law enforcement and our laws allow us to do, which is to really look at the emotional parts of the violence, to look at and to track and to trace other forms of violence that were engaging and other forms of aggression that were engaged in that, in the, in that relationship. And that did take time, but once we all came together and had the ability to look at the mounds of materials that they had gathered, we were able to make a collective decision.
We're talking with Tanya Lovelace. She's CEO of the Women of Color Network. Still time for your insights on violence against women. What resources do you wish women have when seeking help? Where do you find hope in your community? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tanya, you work as a consultant with the NFL. What have you learned through this experience working with a large organization, many men in it, through your training and work?
Well, I will be, to be transparent, I am not one of the domestic violence advisors that they have. They actually have four advisors. That would be Jane Randall, Tony Porter, Beth Ritchie, oh goodness.
That's okay. That's okay. It's early.
but there was a collective of them, these individuals that are actually doing the training, and then they've extended to up to others. So I've not had the ability to do that. Since this time, though, we have had the ability to, we are now, while we are not, while I am no longer serving as a consultant on those individual cases, we have moved into a different approach with them, which is now we are a funded organization with them, and we are able to use those funds from the NFL to engage in wellness and healing practices with women of color, and to capture what we're seeing there with women of color who are advocates that are doing this work. Many are survivors. Many are holding various forms of trauma, and as well as the work of with individuals experiencing trauma. And so we're able to do that work as well as to nurture and to support the leadership specifically of African-American leader, women of color who are leaders in their programs to bolster their leadership. What I can say overall, though, about the NFL in our conversations that we have had is that we do know that it is a daunting job, right, to work with individuals to help them really, as we've been, I'm going to use the term again, connect the dots between the type of engagement that they do on the field and then how they have their how they engage and conduct themselves in their relationships with their partners or other individuals that they are having intimate relationships with. And what we are and what I understand overall is that we are helping them and really seeking to support them in being able to turn that off once they leave the field, but also being able to really be further in touch with their emotions and their own experiences, because for years, these individuals and boys in general have been told that their emotions are not to be displayed. And the only acceptable emotion that they often are able to have is that of anger, or is that, or to engage in some type of hypermasculinity or control behavior. And so we are really hoping that they and supporting them in engaging in healthy masculinity and healthy manhood. And that is the approaches that myself and all of my partners, and we do engaging men work as well. And so, and we, I am on the board of North American Men Engage Network and work, and we are connected to Global Men Engage. And so on a global scale, we are working to reshape ways in which masculinities and manhood are experienced by boys and men.
Have you seen some evolving changes there, even working within the NFL over years, to the attitudes about violence against women?
I think what we are seeing is over time a shifting of it. So I'm going to be, from my perspective, I think that it does start from from the corporate space. We often, when we do work with programs and organizations, we believe it's important to start with the environment of the organization itself, and then support them in how they then work with their constituents. And so we are seeing a shift within the NFL itself. And the ways, I mean, I had direct engagement with Roger Goodell. I had direct engagement with individuals that he holds close and that he trusts in really helping to look at these issues. And I know that they are shifting in the way that they see and embrace this. And what we are doing is helping them and hope that they will extend that. It is a work in progress. They are not all the way there yet, and they are working on being there, right?
Tanya Lovelace is with us from the Women of Color Network, Inc., doing advocacy work around gender-based violence. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. The Women of Color Network, Inc. has a list of things that are eroding the lives of Black women and girls, and that list includes poverty and poor education. It includes limited job resources. Maybe you have experiences with sexual assault or domestic violence. How has gender-based violence, violence directed at you because of your gender, how has it affected your world? What is the next step here? Still time for your perspective, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tanya Lovelace is CEO of the Pennsylvania-based Women of Color Network, Inc., and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Charlotte is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. Hey, I like what you said about maybe teaching young boys and maybe focusing more on teaching the young than, you know what I mean, it maybe helping older men, but it seems like you should start where they're young.
Yeah.
Build a foundation there.
So Charlotte is saying, you know, we need to start early on the education, Tanya.
Yes, absolutely. I think we spend too much time focused on why girls stay, why women stay, and not enough time on how is it that men and boys are finding themselves engaging in this behavior. And so what we are trying to do is, and I include boys in that, I have to say sadly that we are seeing evidence of this type of power and control in relationships as early as fifth grade, sixth grade. So the earlier we can begin to interrupt, or to, as the caller is saying, to start early, to start even earlier than that, is so important. It is so essential to really reshaping the way that that boys and girls and men and women and individuals across gender identity engage.
Charlotte, thanks for the call. Tanya, I want to pick your brain for a moment on the Me Too movement, which really emerged a couple years ago, revealed decades of sexual misconduct in Hollywood and in politics. What do you think has changed since then?
I think the idea that we can even connect the dots between what is happening to girls and women in a private space, and really making sure that people understand that that matters on a public level is, it's something that this field has been doing, and I mean, that has always been the focus of this field, but to see it break open in this way from a person, Tarana Burke, who herself was a survivor, who was seeking to support young girls of color herself, and really realized that at some point, I believe she says that a girl came to her that she did not have the emotional bandwidth that day to really say to her, I hear what you're saying, me too. But from that point forward, decided that she was going to do that. And that's how she started the hashtag Me Too and the concept of Me Too. And later on, when it got picked up and they had to tie it back to her original work, it still comes back to girls, and it still comes back to individuals. And the idea that this is now center stage is so critical and so key for our field and for the country overall. It is just amazing. And we do see that there is shifts that happen, but so many more shifts need to happen.
Tanya, as we have to let you go here in just a moment, I want to ask you, what is the hardest part of your work? What keeps you persevering over all these years on such a difficult issue?
I think that it's both hard, but also makes it easy for me to do this work in the sense that I too am a survivor. That platform, this is my life work, because it is my life. And when the Women of Color Network, we say, we are the work. And that is because, again, this can happen to anyone. And so it's important to, for me, I see this as a point of survival for myself, for individuals that I want to reach within my own family and within my own community. But on a broader scale, on a global scale, we are seeking to really overturn and really change the world. We really want to end sexual violence and domestic violence. And that is no small feat. And that keeps me going every day.
Tanya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. Thank you so much.
Tanya Lovelace is CEO of the Women of Color Network, Inc. We've been talking about the work to end gender-based violence against women of color in their communities. We have a link to the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault on our morning show page at WPR.org. Their number is 608-257-1516. Cannabidiol, or CBD oil, has presented countless business opportunities and helped relieve seizures in children with a rare form of epilepsy. But Wisconsin's approval of the substance in 2014 has also brought on more complications. As Shemaine Mills reports, this creates a dilemma for agencies which oversee the substance and researchers who are studying it.
So what this is called is a vortexer. So it's a way of actually mixing things by spinning them really fast. So Cecilia Hillard is a professor of pharmacology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. As she washes a laboratory beaker, she explains how she studied the anti-inflammatory properties of CBD, a marijuana extract that doesn't get people high.
It clearly reduces the response of the body to inflammation, and I do think that this is one of the more promising effects of CBD. We've been studying it a little bit in some other things that haven't shown much effect. We've looked at it in animal models of pain, and it has not been very effective.
But don't tell that to Ryan Barnes.
I'm all for it. CBD has been a life changer not only for me, but for a lot of other people I know.
Barnes recalls how he used to take prescription medication to control anxiety while in college, trying to juggle studies and work at the same time.
The stress is real.
But how effective is the cure? It depends on what condition you're trying to alleviate. Hillard says a study from Germany suggests that CBD may be a good treatment for schizophrenia. Research in New York indicates it might help prevent cravings in heroin addicts. But other uses?
It's hard to really recommend it because we have not been able to do placebo-controlled studies in human beings. So you get concerned that there's a lot of expectation, particularly for things like sleep or anxiety, where the end point can be quite subjective.
Hillard laments that CBD oil is being used in ways that may not help or could even hurt people. For example, she notes it's being used by parents to treat ADHD and autism in children. Pregnant women are taking it to treat nausea and pain. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has advised against using cannabis and its more straight-laced cousin, CBD, while pregnant. The agency has also issued warning letters to companies making claims about CBD, which the government says are not substantiated.
Consumers should know that CBD products that are on the market today have not received FDA review or approval.
That's Patricia Kelmar, Director of Health Policy for the National Consumers League. The group says sales of unregulated products are soaring and more needs to be done to ensure people and pets are safe.
Sure, you're around.
I recently visited a CBD store near the UW-Madison campus called the Green Barn Door. Sure enough, they're banking on at least some of their customer base being canines.
So this is our pet section over here, and the bowl is just, you know, in case people want to walk in with their furry little friend. And yeah, we got drops, we got pet treats, we got, you know, sprays you can put on their food.
Ryan Barnes not only uses CBD, he oversees sales for the Green Barn Door, and they sell pretty much anything you can imagine, only with CBD oil in it.
Is that really caramel sauce with CBD oil?
Yeah, just in time for the holidays.
Any chocolate here?
Like other retailers selling CBD, they hope sales will continue to grow.
Hey, will that be all for you?
As over-the-counter purchases of CBD rise, researchers like Hillard would like to see more regulation. Without it, she says, the potential of CBD as a proven drug may never be realized beyond controlling seizures in kids. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.